Chapter 6. In the end, the decision of whether to send an advance team to Chittagong, Bangladesh's principal port city, or wait and drive the Oregon hard around the Indian subcontinent, was made easy by the simple fact that the ship had never been there and none of their contacts had a trustworthy man in the area. If they couldn't guarantee getting the supplies and equipment they needed, there was no sense sending a group ahead to even try. They would lose 5 days getting the ship into position, 5 days in which the trail would grow colder. While this rankled Cabrillo and the rest of the crew, the demand for a face-to-face meeting with Roland Crossar annoyed even more. When Juan had sent his acceptance email to L'Enfant, the reply had been swift, as it always was. The financial terms had already been agreed upon, but Crossar had added the stipulation that he get to meet with Cabrillo. Juan had only agreed to meet Gunawan Bahar because the man had flown to Mumbai, where the Oregon had just offloaded 2 containers of South African millet that had been lashed to the forward deck. Crossar was currently in Singapore and wanted Cabrillo to come to him. It meant Juan had to chopper back to Karachi, get on the GV, fly to Singapore, hold the man's hand for an hour or two, then head off to either Chennai, formerly Madras, or Vishakhapatnam on India's east coast. Which city would depend on the length of the meeting and the speed the Oregon could maintain. Once there, they would need to slow the ship so Gomez Adams could chopper in to pick him up. Any number of bureaucratic snafus could hold him up. He'd replied to L'Enfant, expressing his concerns, but was told the client was adamant. What bothered Cabrillo was the fact that until he could somehow get the corporation back in the good graces of the United States government, he had no choice but to accept assignments like this. Like any business, they had overhead and expenses that translated to about $200,000 a day. Taking out entire terrorist cells, thwarting some major attack before it happened, these were the things he'd created the corporation for. That was why he'd joined the CIA in the first place. And knowing that for the time being he had been marginalized to a degree, ate at the back of his mind. He decided to take Max with him, for no other reason than to have his company during the long flights. That left Linda Ross in charge of the ship. After she'd gotten out of the Navy, Linda had captained a rig tender in the Gulf of Mexico. She could handle a ship as well as she could handle a gun. They landed at Changi Airport, to the north of the futuristic city-state of Singapore. Its skyline was punctuated by some of the most beautiful architecture in the world, including the new Marina Bay Sands Hotel, their destination. Hanley was nearly inconsolable when Juan told him they wouldn't have the time to hit the hotel's casino. As was usual when arriving on a private jet, customs was a mere formality. The uniformed agent met them at the stairs when they stepped from the plane, glanced at, then stamped their passports, and didn't ask to see the contents of Cabrillo's sleek briefcase. Not that they were hiding anything in it. Though they had flown casual, both had put on suits and ties just prior to landing. Juan wore an elegantly cut charcoal with a faint pinstripe that was picked up in the colors of his $200 tie. His brogues were buffed to a glossy black. Keeping shoes spit-polished was a fetish he shared with the Oregon steward. Max wasn't wearing off-the-rack exactly, but he looked uncomfortable. His collar dug into the spare flesh around his neck, and there was the tiniest trace of an old stain on his left sleeve. The air was decidedly warmer here than in Karachi, and while they couldn't detect it over the smell of hot asphalt and jet fuel, it carried the tropical humidity associated with the sea. The equator was only 85 miles to their south. Juan checked his watch an all-black Movado that was barely thicker than a piece of paper. We've got an hour. Perfect. Though offered a super-stretch limousine, they took a less ostentatious town car into the city. Traffic was absolute murder, and yet remarkably polite. There were no blaring horns, no aggressive driving techniques. It made Juan recall that for all its wealth and sophistication, Singapore was virtually a police state. Free speech was severely limited, and spitting on a sidewalk could get you caned. This tended to create a homogeneous population with a keen respect for the law, and thus no one cut you off or flipped you the bird. Their destination rose along the water in three gracefully sloped white towers, each more than 50 stories tall. Atop them was a platform that stretched for nearly a fifth of a mile, one part of it cantilevering off the third tower a good 200 feet. This was known as the Sky Park, and even from a distance, they could see the profusion of trees and shrubbery that adorned it. The Sky Park side facing the marina was composed of three infinity-edge swimming pools, holding almost 400,000 gallons of water. At the base of the hotel towers were three enormous domed buildings, housing the casino, exclusive shops, and convention spaces. Rumor had it, the casino resort was the second most expensive on the planet. The car pulled up to the hotel entrance, and a liveried doorman was there even before the tires had stopped turning.
"Welcome to the Marina Bay Sands," he said in cultured English.
Cabrillo suspected that had he looked Scandinavian, he would have been greeted in flawless Swedish.
"Do you have any baggage?"
Juan jerked a finger at where Max was heaving himself out of the car.
"Just him."
They stepped through into the hotel's soaring lobby. It was crowded with vacationers. A group of them were assembled for some sort of tour and were receiving instructions in sing-song Chinese from a female guide who couldn't have been 4.5 feet tall. The line waiting to check in snaked through a velvet rope maze. With 2,500 rooms, this was more like a small city than a single enterprise. Juan found the concierge desk and told the attractive Malay girl that she had an envelope for him. He gave his name, and she asked for identification. Inside the envelope was a credit card-style room key and one of Roland Croissard's business cards. Scrawled on the back was the financier's room number. They needed to show the armed guard near the elevators that they had a proper room key. Juan flashed it, and they gained entry. They took the car up to the 40th floor with a Korean couple who were arguing the entire way. Cabrillo imagined that the man had gambled away the family kimchi money. The hallways were muted and somewhat dimly lit, unlike the layout of some of the mega casinos they had been in. The three-tower design meant they weren't left walking forever to find the right room. Cabrillo knocked on Quasar's door.
"Maman,"
a voice said, dropping the T like a French speaker. The door opened. The man standing there, nearly blocking the door from jam to jam, was not Roland Croissard. They'd seen photographs of him while researching his background. In that first half second, Juan noted that the man's jacket was off, his hands empty, and his expression wasn't overtly aggressive. This wasn't an ambush, and so he relaxed his right arm, which was about to deliver a karate strike to the man's nose that more than likely would have killed him. The man grunted. He'd seen how quickly the chairman had perceived and then discounted a potential threat.
"Monsieur Cabrillo,"
the voice called from farther in the suite. The gorilla who'd opened the door stepped aside. He was nearly as big as Franklin Lincoln, but where Link's face was normally open and easygoing, this one maintained a permanent scowl. His hair was dark, cut unfashionably, and looked like something from a 1970s adult movie.
He had hooded, watchful eyes that tracked Juan as he stepped into the opulent two-room suite. He had shaved that morning, but already needed another. Hired muscle, was Cabrillo's assumption, and too obvious about it. The good bodyguards were the ones you never suspected. They looked like accountants or entry-level CSRs at a bank, not hulking wrestler types who thought their size alone was intimidating enough. Juan resisted the impulse to put the guy down for the fun of it. The guard indicated that Juan and Max should fan open their coats so he could see if they were carrying concealed weapons. To get things moving along, the two men from the corporation indulged him. He didn't bother to check their ankles. Cabrillo wondered if this guy was really that bad or if he'd been told these were expected guests and should be treated accordingly. He decided the latter, which meant the man had overstepped his authority by asking them to open their coats. His abilities went up a notch in Juan's mind. He took protecting his boss more seriously than his orders to let them enter unmolested. "Could you button your shirt sleeves, please?" Juan asked him.
"What?"
"Your sleeves are down but unbuttoned, which means you have a knife strapped to your forearm. I've already noticed you aren't wearing an ankle holster, and yet somehow I don't think you're unarmed, hence the unbuttoned sleeves." Roland Quasar rose from a sofa on the far end of the room. A briefcase and papers were strewn across the coffee table. A glass with ice and a clear liquid sat in a puddle of condensation. He wore suit pants and a tie. His jacket was draped across an overstuffed chair that was part of the same furniture cluster.
"It's okay, John," he said. "These men are here to help find Soleil."
The guard, John, scowled a little deeper as he buttoned his cuffs. When he bent his elbow, the cotton of his shirt bulged against a low-profile knife sheath.
"Monsieur Cabrillo," Quasar said, "thank you so much for coming."
The Swiss man was of medium height and starting to show a paunch, but he had a handsome face and penetrating blue eyes. His hair, an indeterminate shade, was thinning and combed straight back. Cabrillo's estimation was that he looked younger than 62, but not remarkably so. Quasar plucked a pair of wire-rimmed reading glasses off his straight nose as he came across the room with his hand extended. His grasp was cool and professional, the shake of a hand that did it for a living.
"This is Max Hanley," Juan introduced, "my second in command."
"And this is my personal security advisor, John Smith."
Cabrillo held out his hand, which Smith begrudgingly shook.
"You must get around a lot," Juan said. "I've seen your name on a lot of hotel registrations."
The man gave no indication he got the joke.
"Why don't we sit down? May I get you gentlemen a drink?"
"Bottled water," Juan said.
He set his briefcase down on an end table and popped the lid. Smith had positioned himself close enough so that he could see inside. Cabrillo pulled two electronic devices from the case and shut the lid again. He flicked one on and studied the small screen. Gone were the days when he had to sweep a room with a bug detector. This handheld could check 100-foot radius instantly. Quasar's suite was clean. In case there was a voice-activated listening device someplace within earshot, he would leave it on. He then went to the window. In the distance were the silver spires of the skyline, made somewhat indistinct by the heat haze that was forming as morning burned into afternoon. He peeled an adhesive backing off the cigarette pack-sized device and stuck it to the thick glass. He hit a button to turn it on. Inside the black plastic casing were two weights powered by a battery and controlled by a micro-random generator. It set the weights in motion, which in turn vibrated the glass. The electronic generator would guarantee that no pattern would emerge that could be decoded and nullified by a computer.
"Qu'est-ce que c'est?"
French wasn't one of the languages Cabrillo spoke, but the question was easy enough to understand.
This shakes the window pane and prevents anyone from using a laser voice detector. He took one last look at the beautiful view, then closed the shears so that no one could see into the suite.
Okay, now we can talk.
I have heard from my daughter, Quasar announced.
Cabrillo felt a ripple of anger.
You could have told me that before we flew halfway around the world.
No, you do not understand. I think she is in more grave danger than I first thought.
Go on.
The call came through about 3 hours ago. Here.
He pulled a sleek PDA from his pant pocket and fumbled through a couple of applications until a woman's voice, sounding very tired and very scared, came through the speaker. She said no more than a few words in French before the call abruptly ended.
She says that she is close. To what, I do not know, but then says that they are closer. She then says that she will never make it, and I do not know who the they she references might be.
May I see that? Juan asked, and held out his hand.
He fiddled with the PDA for a moment and hit play to repeat the recording. Quasar talked him through it, and once again they heard Soleil's breathless voice. There was a noise in the background, maybe wind through leaves, maybe anything at all. Juan played it a third time, then a fourth. The background became no clearer.
Can you send this to my phone? I want to have the recording analyzed.
Of course.
Juan gave him the number on the phone he was currently carrying, one that would have its SIM card pulled when the mission was over.
Were you able to get her GPS coordinates?
Yes.
Quasar unfolded a map that had been lying in his briefcase. It was a topographical map of Myanmar done before the country changed its name from Burma. Faint X's had been marked with a fine-tipped mechanical pencil, and the longitude and latitude numbers added next to them. Cabrillo was familiar with them, having seen a copy of Quasar's map already. But there was a new notation about 20 miles northeast of Soleil's last known location.
You've tried to call her back? Juan asked, knowing the answer.
Yes, every 15 minutes. There is no reply.
Well, this is good news, Cabrillo said. It's proof of life, even if it sounds like she's in trouble. As you must understand, we need some more time to get everything into position. An operation of this nature must be carefully thought out so it can be precisely executed.
That has already been explained to me, Quasar replied, obviously not liking that simple truth.
We'll be ready in 3 days' time. Your daughter is already past effective helicopter range, which will make our jobs a little tougher. But mark my words, we will find her.
Merci, monsieur. You have a reputation for success. There is one final piece to this affair, he added.
Juan cocked an eyebrow, not liking the tone in the financier's voice.
Yes?
I want John to accompany you.
Out of the question.
Monsieur, this is not a negotiable request. I believe the expression is my charter, my rules, yes?
Mr. Quasar, this isn't a fishing trip. We could be facing armed guerrillas, and I simply can't allow an unknown man to come with us.
Cabrillo planned on bringing McDee Lawless, who was a bit of an unknown himself, but the financier didn't need to know that. Wordlessly, John Smith unbuttoned the cuff where he didn't carry the knife. He pulled up his sleeve to reveal a faded blue tattoo. It showed a flaming circle above the words, Marche ou Crève. Cabrillo recognized it as the emblem for the French Foreign Legion and its unofficial motto, March or Die. Juan looked at him levelly.
Sorry, Mr. Smith. All that tells me is that you visited a tattoo parlor.
It would explain Smith's generic name, though. Legionnaires often adopted nom de guerre.
About 15 years ago, by the looks of it, Max added.
Smith didn't say anything, but Cabrillo could see the anger building behind the man's dark eyes. Juan also recognized that he was between a rock and a hard place, because ultimately he would have to cave if he wanted the contract. Tell you what, Cabrillo said, and lifted up his trouser leg. Quasar and Smith were startled at the sight of his prosthetic leg. Cabrillo had several that had been tricked out by the wizards in the Oregon's magic shop. This particular one was called the Combat Leg Version 2.0. He opened a concealed area behind the flesh-colored calf and pulled out a small automatic pistol. He popped the 7-shot magazine and cleared around from the chamber. He showed it to Smith for just a second and said, "Eyes on me." Then he handed it over. Smith knew what the test entailed, and, without moving his gaze from Juan's eyes, he quickly disassembled the small pistol down to its basic parts, and then, just as quickly, put it back together again. He gave it back butt first. It took him about 40 seconds.
"Geltec P-380, he said. "Based on their P-22, but chambered for 380. Nice gun to fit in a lady's purse."
Juan laughed, breaking the tension. "I tried fitting a Desert Eagle 50 caliber in this leg, but it was just a tad obvious." He slipped the gun and the magazine, plus the loose bullet, into his coat pocket.
"Where have you served?"
"Chad, Haiti, Iraq, of course, Somalia, a few other third-world hotspots."
Cabrillo shifted his attention back to Quasar.
"You've got your deal. He passes."
"Good. Then it is settled. John will accompany you now back to your aircraft, and then you will find my soleil."
"No, he's going to meet up with us in Chittagong. In case you aren't aware, that's a port city in Bangladesh." Smith wasn't going to be aboard the Oregon a second longer than necessary. "And that, I'm sorry, is non-negotiable."
"D'accord. But if you do not pick him up as promised, do not think you will get my money."
"Mr. Quasar," Juan said solemnly, "I am many things, but a man who backs out on his word isn't one of them." The two men studied each other for a moment. Quasar nodded.
"No, I don't suppose that you are."
They shook hands. As they exchanged phone numbers with Smith, Max pulled their laser defeater from the window and packed up the bug detector. He snapped the briefcase closed and handed it to Cabrillo.
"If you hear anything from her, no matter the time, call me immediately," Juan told Quasar at the suite's door.
"I will, I promise. Please, bring her back to me. She is headstrong and stubborn, but she is my daughter, and I love her very much."
"We'll do our best," Juan said, because he would never promise something he couldn't deliver. "Well?" Max asked, as they were striding down the hallway heading for the elevators.
"I don't like it, but what choice did we have?"
"That's why the face-to-face, to spring Smith on us at the last minute."
"Yeah, pretty cagey of him."
"So? Are we going to trust him?"
"Smith? Not on your life. There's something they're not telling us, and he's the key."
"We should back out of this whole thing,"
Max opined.
"No way, my friend. If anything, I'm more interested than ever in what the lovely Miss Quasar was doing so deep into Burma."
"Myanmar," Hanley corrected.
"Whatever."
They exited the elevator and started crossing the busy lobby when Cabrillo suddenly hit himself on the head as if he'd forgotten something and grabbed Max's elbow to turn them around.
"What is it? Did you forget something?" Hanley asked.
Juan had picked up his pace ever so slightly.
"I noticed two guys hanging around the lobby when we first entered. Both look local, but they're wearing long coats. One of them noticed us when we got into view and quickly turned away. Too quickly."
"Who are they?"
"Don't know, but they're not with Quasar. If he wanted us dead, he would have had Smith shoot us as soon as we entered his room. And he knows we're going back to the airport. So what's the point of following us?"
Max saw no flaw in Cabrillo's logic, so he just grunted. They approached the express elevator for the Sky Park. By feel, Juan was able to insert the magazine back into his Kel-Tec automatic. He even managed to cock the weapon against his hip bone without taking it from his jacket pocket. The two men were making their move, coming across the lobby without taking their eyes off the corporation duo. The elevator door pinged open.
Juan and Max didn't wait for it to empty before shouldering their way in, all but ignoring the looks of indignation thrown their way. It wasn't even going to be close. The men had waited too long, and now the elevator doors were closing. It was too public out in the lobby to pull any sort of weapon, so Juan threw them a taunting smile as the doors met with a hiss.
"Now what?" Max asked, as they were carried skyward.
Juan took the opportunity to load the ejected bullet into the pistol.
"We get to the top, wait about 5 minutes, and then head back down again."
"And what will they be doing, pray tell?"
"Splitting up to cover the lobbies of the other two towers. They'll never think we'd stay in this one."
"And if they decide to follow us up?"
"Never happen," Juan dismissed with a shake of his head.
"I still wonder who they are," Max said,
as they neared the 55th floor and the Sky Park.
"My money's on the local secret police. Something about our plane's registration or our passports sent up a red flag, and these gentlemen want to ask us a few questions."
"So how'd they know we'd be here at the—"
Max stopped asking his question and then answered it.
"They talked to the car service that brought us to the hotel."
"Elementary, my dear Hanley."
The doors open, and they stepped out onto one of the greatest engineering marvels in the world. The 100,000-square-foot platform, sitting atop the three towers, was like Babylon's famous Hanging Gardens, only these weren't the exclusive environs of Nebuchadnezzar and his wife Amytis. Trees provided excellent shade, while the flowering shrubs perfumed the air nearly 1,000 feet above the streets. The long swimming pools, with their dizzying infinity edges, were sparkling blue and surrounded by sunbathers. To their left was an eating area cantilevered off the third tower so that it hung suspended in space. Diners were lounging under bright umbrellas while waitstaff danced between the tables, bearing trays of food and drinks. The view over Singapore Harbor was absolutely breathtaking.
"Man, I could get used to this," Max said,
as a woman in a bikini passed close enough for him to smell the coconut in her tanning lotion.
"You ogle any harder, your eyes are going to pop out."
Juan led them away from the elevator and took up a position so they could see it on the off chance that the two secret policemen had followed them up. He was pretty sure they wouldn't, but he hadn't stayed alive in such a dangerous profession for so long by not being cautious. A moment later, the elevator doors parted again. Cabrillo tensed, his hand in his pocket, his finger resting along the trigger guard. He knew he wouldn't shoot it out with these guys. Singapore had the death penalty. But, if need be, he could toss the pistol into a bush to his right and avoid a major weapons violation, provided they didn't find the second one-shot gun embedded in his artificial leg. A family, dressed for a little time under the sun, emerged, the father holding the hand of a little pigtailed girl. An older boy immediately rushed to look over the railing at the miniature cityscape so far below. The doors started to close. Juan blew out his breath and was about to make a snarky comment to Max when a hand appeared between the gleaming elevator doors and stopped them from closing entirely. Cabrillo cursed. It was them. They looked out of place with their long dark coats and their darting eyes. He backed a little deeper into the trees. They would have to sneak along the back side of the restaurant to get to the elevator housing for the third tower. To do that, they would need to scale a concrete retaining wall, and that might attract the attention of one of the servers or pool attendants. It couldn't be helped. He put his foot on the first tier of the wall and was about to boost himself up when an eagle-eyed lifeguard a dozen yards away shouted for him to stop. He must have been watching them the whole time and suspected they were up to something. The two agents immediately were on guard and started moving toward them, even though Juan and Max were still out of their direct line of vision. The time for subtlety was over. Juan heaved himself up onto the wall, climbing the three tiers with the agility of a monkey. When he reached the top, he lowered a hand to help Max. The lifeguard began climbing off his little mahogany tower and blowing his whistle to attract additional security. He either hadn't noticed or had dismissed the two men in trench coats. The agents burst into view. One threw open his coat and brought up a vicious-looking machine pistol. Max was halfway up the wall, as exposed as a bug on an entomologist's lab table. Juan had a split second to make a decision, and he did so without hesitation. He dropped Max. Just as the agent pulled the trigger, cement dust and chips exploded off the wall where Max had been dangling. People started screaming and stampeding away from the chainsaw-like whine of the machine pistol as the entire 30-round clip was emptied against the concrete wall, inches above Max's prone form. Not knowing what was going on, but acting on instinct and adrenaline, Cabrillo drew the Caltech and returned fire. His first rounds were snapshots, just trying to break the gunman's fixation on perforating Max. The gunman jerked slightly as a more carefully aimed yet still a little wild bullet struck the crown of his head. The second agent started opening his coat, where he doubtlessly had his own weapon. Juan shifted his sights and, to his horror, saw that the agent was wearing a heavy suicide vest. He could see the packs of explosives and other bags that would contain metal scrap for shrapnel.
"Allahu Akbar!" the man shrieked.
Juan put a bullet down his open throat, and the man fell back like a marionette with its strings cut. The first gunman had blood sheeting down his face and was staggering backward, dazed by the .380 caliber bullet that had gouged a trench through the top of his skull. He dropped his machine pistol down onto its sling and was fumbling in his coat pocket. Juan couldn't get a clear shot at him as people continued to streak past, not realizing they were blundering into the middle of the gunfight. He knew this first guy was probably also packing a vest and made the decision that hitting one of the civilians with a stray bullet was preferable to dozens of them getting mowed down in an explosion. A hotel guard finally arrived. He'd been on the far side of the platform and hadn't seen a thing. He noticed the one man down on the ground in a pool of his own blood, paid no attention to the guy with blood on his face, and instead trained his attention on Cabrillo, an obviously armed target. He started to raise his pistol and nearly had it centered on Cabrillo when Max threw himself across the intervening 10 yards and hit him like a linebacker. They crashed to the ground in a tangle of limbs, bowling over another man in the process. Juan took a chance and fired again. He hit the bomber in the chest, but the man merely staggered back from the impact. The bullet had hit one of the bags of nails, which stopped it like body armor. The Caltech slide was locked back over an empty chamber. Cabrillo flipped himself around so that his foot was pointing toward the gunman. The barrel of the .44 caliber pistol hidden inside his prosthetic leg made up its central support strut to give it as much length and thus accuracy as possible. There was only one round, so essentially the weapon was just a tube with a dual-trigger firing mechanism that ensured it couldn't accidentally discharge. When he hit the second trigger, it felt like someone had slammed the bottom of his stump with a sledgehammer. The round punched through the sole of his shoe, and the recoil almost knocked him off his perch. The heavy 300-grain bullet entered the bomber's body in the abdomen, its kinetic energy lifting him off his feet like he'd been jerked from behind. He hit the pool, his body parting the water, and sank from sight when the vest detonated. Water geysered in a solid white column that rose 40 feet over the deck before crashing back like a torrential rain. The blast had been big enough and close enough to blow out part of the pool's steel side. Water gushed through the opening, dancing and twisting as it fell over the side of the building on its long journey to the ground. The once bucolic swimming pool had become one of the tallest waterfalls in the world. There was nothing left of the bomber, and with the pool absorbing so much of the explosive force and the shrapnel, it didn't appear that anyone had been injured, at least seriously. Cabrillo's hearing was just returning after the sonic assault of the blast. More people were screaming now, running, panicked and unsure of where to go or what to do. Over all this, he detected a high keening wail, a sound of true mortal danger that cut above the fearful bleating of hotel guests. There was a little boy still in the pool, his arms supported by plastic water wings. He'd been in the shallow end, playing by himself, when all the adults had scrambled from the water at the opening salvos of the attacks, and apparently his parents hadn't had the time to rescue him. As the water drained through the twisted opening, sucked through it like it was a high-speed pump, the floating child was being drawn inexorably toward the shattered metal. Juan leapt off the 8-foot retaining wall and sprinted across the deck. He threw himself into a perfect dive that would have gotten applause from Olympic judges and struck out for the boy. He could feel the current pulling on his body. It was like trying to fight a riptide. He had been a strong swimmer his entire life and had been able to stroke his way out of some pretty dangerous situations, but nothing had prepared him for the raw power of the pool draining through its blown-out side. The hole was at least 4 feet in diameter. He reached the child when they still had about 10 feet to go before he would be sucked through. The kid flailed his arms, crying beyond all reason. Juan grabbed him by the hair to get out of the reach of his thrashing arms and tried to tow him clear, but the surge was simply too much to fight one-handed. He looked around in desperation. No one had seen what he was doing. The hole was a bright spot near the bottom of the pool where sunlight illuminated the eddies and whirlpools that formed and dissolved as the water poured into infinity. Cabrillo put on a burst of speed, his legs pistoning and his free arm hauling back with everything he had. For every foot he gained, the pool took back two. The vortex was just too strong. He had seconds before he was pulled through the rent in the side of the pool. He did the only thing open to him. He stopped swimming. And then twisted around so that he was facing the gaping tear. As they were drawn closer, he held the child up in his arms. He would have one shot, one instant, when he could make this happen and save them both. If not, he and the boy would be sucked out of the pool and sent plummeting 1,000 feet to their deaths. They were less than 2 feet away. The water was still too deep to stand, so Cabrillo kicked hard, raising his upper body out of the water. He threw the boy at the ledge surrounding the swimming pool, sank down to the bottom, and sprang up again. He launched himself partially out of the water and hit the side of the pool directly over the tear in its side. The relentless pull sucked at his dangling legs and nearly drew him back in again before he managed to get a better grip on the cement and haul himself completely free. He looked to his side. The boy was just pulling himself upright, tears cutting through the water on his face. His right elbow bent as he examined the scrape he'd gotten when he hit the deck. Only when he saw that it was beginning to bleed a little did he begin to wail like a fire engine. Juan got to his feet and snatched up the kid so he wouldn't fall in again. He hooked up with Max, dumped the sniveling boy next to a potted palm, and joined the frenzied exodus off the sky park. 10 minutes later, just as police were starting to arrive at the resort en masse, they hit the lobby. Any attempt at a security cordon at this point was never going to happen, and the cops seemed to realize it. People streamed out of the building like a herd of frightened animals. Cabrillo and Hanley allowed themselves to be borne along with the tide of humanity. Once out of the building, they made their way down to the far end of a line of taxis and hopped into the last cab in the string. The driver was about to protest that he couldn't take fares until it was his turn, but stopped himself when he saw the 300 Singapore dollar bills in Cabrillo's hand. He didn't even care that they were wet.